tax update for Saturday, June the 3rd, 2006. Welcome to Tax Update. This week, we take a look at a recent alimony case where the taxpayers in question had not defined what their payments were going to be, and the court had to decide. Tax Update podcast is intended, as always, for tax professionals and is not designed for those not skilled in independent tax research. All readers and listeners are expected to do their own research to confirm items raised in this presentation before relying upon the positions presented. The podcast and the document can be freely reproduced so long as no fee is charged for the use of the document or the podcast. Such prohibited use would include using the podcast or the document as part of a CP presentation for which a fee is charged. The podcast is sponsored by Limeburg Information Services on the web at www.limeburgservices.com. You can visit them on the web as they offer to tax professionals who subscribe to their services email newsletters on matters of current interest, as well as access to a library of tax-related information. Again, visit them on the web at www.limeburgservices.com. This week, we take a look at the case of Johansson versus Commissioner, Tax Court Memorandum 2006-105. This case deals with alimony, a subject we covered back on December 3rd, and you might want to take a look back at those materials. We're going to go forward this week on alimony. In those two cases that we decided back then, we had the payor who didn't get his deduction for alimony paid. In this case, we find the opposite result can occur too. Your taxpayer who's receiving payments may discover that the taxpayer has received alimony, even if the taxpayer believes that's not what was being paid. The problem in this case, as the judge points out, who has to decide the case, is that the taxpayers left the particular issue undecided, so the tax court essentially got to decide this significant issue between them because they clearly didn't agree on what it was. Remind you, going back for alimony, we go back and we look at the key issue here comes again under Section 71, and rather specifically under Section 71B1. And the issue under Section 71B1 is again, as we discussed back in December, a four-part test. If you meet all four tests, the payment is alimony. The test requires that the payment be received by or on behalf of a spouse under a divorce or separation instrument. And we have a definition of what that is if you look at 71B2. Secondly, the divorce or the separation instrument cannot say this is not alimony. If the document says these payments are not alimony, they are not, no matter what they do about meeting the other tests. The third test, in case of an individual legally separated from spouse under decree of divorce or separate maintenance, the payee spouse and the payor spouse are not members of the same household at the time such payment is made. You can't create alimony if they are living in the same household. And fourth, and what becomes the key issue in today's case, there's no liability to make any such payment for any period after the death of the payee spouse. And there is no liability to make any payment in cash or property as a substitute for such payments after the death of the payee spouse. Now, in the case of Johansson, that last issue becomes the key one. Because in the Johansson case, the parties agreed that the first three issues were applicable. In essence, these payments meet all of those particular rules. And that would be true quite often. The payment is going to be coming under a divorce decree. Well, usually there are payments under such a decree. And the individual was legally separated, didn't live together. Well, that's normally true. Most of my divorced spouses do not live together, so they usually qualify under that one. And the most important issue, if you're the spouse who's receiving these payments, the decree didn't say it wasn't alimony. Note, that provides a very sure method if your client believes the payments should not be treated as alimony to make sure they're not. You simply put in the decree, these payments are not to be treated as alimony and are not to be allowable as a deduction under Section 215. If that clause had been in Johansson's document, we wouldn't be in court. The fourth case is the liability to make such payment after the death of the payee spouse. This is probably where the payors tend to get in trouble more often. The problem there is you can make it explicit at the death of the recipient spouse these payments cease and no other payments are made to substitute for those payments. Again, the problem in this case was, just as this document did not say, and so was kind of flawed from the perspective of drafting on the part of the recipient spouse, that these payments were not alimony, the document also did not say the payments in question were not to continue after the death of the recipient spouse. Rather, the clause was silent on that point. So what the court ended up having to do in the Johansson case was go back and look at underlying state law. Now, the court discusses quite a bit about what went on. Not inconsiderably, the court found a number in the findings of facts recited back some of the payments and what went on. Now, the court gives us a commentary indicating that the judge is not terribly thrilled that he's being asked to decide this case. As the case tells us, this case is another chapter in the long saga of cases decided by this court involving the failure of parties to divorce settlement agreements to specify what happens to payments should the payee spouse die. By failing to so specify, the divorce litigants simply abdicate making a serious financial decisions that others may then make for them, as here. This was a key issue. The judge is essentially saying, and I think quite appropriately, that this should have been settled before it got here. In essence, a clause should have been included indicating either these payments continue or they do not continue after the death of the recipient spouse. Secondly, to be honest, from the recipient spouse, we could have made that whole point moot by simply saying they are not alimony. Again, neither thing happened in this case. Now, of course, each side testified in the case, and as the judge points out, not unexpectedly, their testimony contradicted each other everywhere. So the judge came down to say, essentially, in deciding this case, I've got to go with a written document, because the parties all give testimony telling them why their position is the way it was. Now, the key issue was whether, in 2002, Carol's payments totaling $63,000 were alimony, a property settlement, or part of a guaranteed payment of streams for a fixed term to Carol or her estate. Now remember, the last two items, had it been a property settlement or had it been a guaranteed stream of income that would have been paid to her estate as well, those two terms would have made it not alimony. The actual agreement provided that these payments from John to Carol were going to be an amount of $5,254 per month, and that it would continue through October 31st, 2010. Now, we discussed in some details about what would happen if John died or if John became disabled. Various things were discussed there about the spousal support and what would happen. But there was nothing discussed about what would happen should Carol die during that period. They were denominated as spousal support, so the court went back and analyzed Section 71. Noted, everybody agreed the first three requirements we talked about were met. So the only issue was, do these payments continue after Carol's death? Now, the court then went to look at California Family Code, Section 43-37. This case was decided under California law. Now, a key caveat before you consider this case for yourself. If you're divorce decree was not issued under California law, or if you're not in California, the parties have never been there, never planned to be there, never will be there, have never set foot in the state of California, don't plan to do so, you have to realize that this case was decided on the basis of the specific state law in question. Had this particular agreement existed in the state of, let's say, Wisconsin or the state of Iowa, the answer may have been very, very different. One key component we find in these cases is that quite often the court has to go back to the applicable state law in order to decide the case, because our problem becomes when these issues are left unstated in the agreement, and in this case it was left unstated what would happen if Carol died. At that point, the court then has to go back. The federal courts end up going back in and having to interpret how state law would work in this case. That becomes a real interesting exercise from time to time. It also gives us the huge caution that when you're looking at these cases for your client, be very, very careful when you have a case like Johansson, that you don't come to a conclusion that an agreement that reads this way will always be alimony, because it is very, very possible, in fact, I suppose almost certain, that under different state law, or perhaps even, you could say, with a different judge looking at the state law itself in question, the court might decide that the payments were not alimony and should not be treated as alimony payments. The California law in question provided that, except as otherwise agreed by parties in writing, the obligation of a party under an order for the support of the other party terminates upon the death of either party or the remarriage of either party. The court now determines that, in fact, California Code Section 4337 applies to these payments. As such, they would terminate if she dies during the terms of the obligation. Now, payments which, as the court points out, which are property settlement are not taxable. And Carroll attempted to argue, well, these really were property settlements. The court went on to note there was nothing in the agreement that remotely suggested these payments were property settlement in any way, shape, or form. In fact, they point out that Carroll was arguing that in her mind, and very likely it was true in her mind, that she had agreed to these payments partially to compensate her for the value of stock in a closely held corporation they owned. But the court pointed out that under the divorce decree, she had agreed that the value of C Supreme, that was the company in question, was in the vicinity of $1.2 million. Since previous to the divorce, Carroll owned 25% of C Supreme, the value of her interest being in the neighborhood of $300,000, a far cry from the total support payments she expected to receive under the agreement. It also cites independently under the equalization provision that they had made a division of property. As such, they noted that there was nothing in here that seemed to indicate in the written agreement that these payments were property settlement rather than being alimony. Now, that's crucial because as a tax preparer, quite often we find clients will come in, and if you question them about the nature of payments, you're going to get a description. It is highly likely that if somebody had asked Carol what type of payment she had received, if someone had asked her the nature of the money coming in, she would have said, oh no, I didn't get alimony. And even if questioned further by somebody who knew the law and said, well, you know, I can't really just accept you didn't get alimony because you received payments you don't think they are. What were these payments for? Carol likely would have said they were to reimburse her for the 25% interest in this company. The problem is the actual written decree says nothing of the sort. Even better, the actual written decree essentially gives a whole different meaning if read in a vacuum. Now, again, that doesn't mean, and I will be quite honest, can clearly believe that Carol believed that, in fact, that was what she did. In fact, that may very well have been the reason she agreed to the divorce settlement. But the problem we ran into is that's not what the written settlement said, and just as clearly, it probably was not what her former spouse believed when he signed off. From his perspective, he believed he was making a spousal support payment and that they had covered this other issue elsewhere. Or at least he legitimately could have believed that. Quite often we find parties in a divorce, when emotions are running high anyway, are going to attribute bad faith almost automatically to the other party in the divorce. As such, what you'll often find is you need to go back just to the written documents and take a look at those documents. At this point, Carol has a problem. The tax court points out what you have here is a alimony settlement that clearly appears to be alimony, with no question that's what it should be, and we are going to tax it to you as alimony received. Now, differentiate this from the cases that we saw back in December. Back then, our problem was that we had payments that mechanically failed one of the tests. That, in fact, in the cases we looked at back then, either failed the test because they would not cease on the death of the spouse, and that wasn't clear that that would happen, or that the payment had not been made as required in cash. There was our payment back then of the questions of whether we had a payment that was going to be made in a note that was being reassigned a non-cash item. And those are both interesting problems and different issues. when you make that statement, you know, you have to take a look at the issues and items in question. Now, all of these cases basically lead us to a very important position for the tax professional. And that position is simple. You need to give your clients good advice when dealing with tax matters related to divorce. All of these cases that we've looked at could have been successfully handled and could have stayed out of the tax court had the parties in question received competent tax advice. Now, in some cases that go to tax court, it seems to be clear that, in fact, the payments, you know, at least one party got good advice, and the other party now is discovering that they weren't told what happened, or at least forgot they were told what happened. Now, that was key in the Vannersdal case that we discussed back in December. That was a November 2005 case. In Vannersdal's case, the decree stated these payments are not alimony. Guess what? The decree makes that statement, they're not. In other cases, like this case, when we looked at Johansson, we finished the day at the end of the day when the court was done, divorce decree was signed, everybody left the courtroom. It wasn't clear which one we had on either party. Either party could have drafted the agreement to have gotten the result they wanted by making a minor change to the document. In the case of the payor spouse, the change that should have been made to make it clear so there was no risk of losing the alimony deduction was that the payments would cease on Carol's death. Now, I suppose we might attribute to counsel for the ex-husband the concept that that counsel knew that California law would require it to cease and therefore was incorporated by reference. But to be quite honest, it seems to be a lot safer not to assume that a federal tax court judge is going to know California law as well or is going to interpret it in the same way. And just having stated the payments would cease on the death of the spouse as required pursuant to the California code provision seems like a reasonable provision that should have been in the document. Similarly, if Carol's counsel truly wanted Carol to have the payments not be alimony, or if Carol's tax advisors had been involved and said Carol is only going to agree to this if it's not alimony, then we should have had a provision drafted that simply stated, as in the Vannersdal case, that these payments are not alimony. That standing alone in and of itself would have been sufficient to have eliminated the question of whether Carol had to pick them up as income. But neither item was in the agreement. The problem was we finished the day with an agreement that said nothing. What do you do? Well, this probably emphasizes that, to be honest, this is clearly an area where two spouses going through a divorce are going to have rather conflicting interests. That raises the key issue we always have about how the problems we will run into if we attempt to represent both spouses. Please remember, under Circular 230, you must get client approval when you have a conflict of interest in representing different clients. It's a smart idea to do anyway. Now, attorneys face a higher standard they have to deal with in conflicts, but if you're not an attorney, you're still subject to the Circular 230 standards, and if you're a CPA, subject to the CPA standards that are going to require you to most likely obtain at least written consent from your client that there is a conflicted position. As well, you need to make it clear if you're going to continue in that mode, which is not suggested, but if you do continue in that mode, it needs to be clear to both parties that I'm not looking at this to do a fair deal. I'm going to tell each of you what's the best interest for you. To get a fair deal requires negotiation among you, and you each have to be aware of it. And to get to a fair deal, what I often tell clients, even when I'm representing just one, and normally when I'm representing just one, is the odds are going to be that in a fair deal, there's going to be parts of it you don't like. The best test for a fair deal is, are there parts of it the other party doesn't like too? So that at the end of the day, you both have an agreement you're not totally happy with, and if that's the case, most likely we got a fair agreement. If either party has an agreement they love perfectly, the odds are the agreement really isn't fair, and somebody's going to discover the problem down the line. Secondly, you need to emphasize to your client that to the extent there are payments between the spouses, you should be involved, or their counsel, who is divorce counsel, should make sure that they have the tax expertise to truly understand the payments, and they need to discuss openly the tax consequences of each type of payment they'll receive. You need to do that because, to be quite honest, reasonably, we would expect that if a payment is going to be treated as alimony, meaning deductible to the payor, includable in income by the recipient, that payment should be higher than if the payment is not going to be alimony. Now, presuming we have payments that would qualify as alimony anyway, and presuming, which may be a big assumption in this case, but presuming the parties can at least work in their joint self-interest, so we're not looking at you doing a break for him or a break for her, we're looking at doing a break overall. If it's clear that we're going to be dealing with differential tax rates, and the paying spouse, which would normally be the case if you're the paying spouse, we would presume the paying spouse has a higher income, that's why they're the paying spouse, has a higher tax bracket, we may be able to use that concept to get the federal government to subsidize and get more money after tax in the pocket of the recipient at a lower cost after tax to the payor. But that requires some planning. Similarly, if the parties insist, and the recipient may, because quite often we're not dealing with rationality here, we're dealing with simply an issue, especially when we deal with taxes, are an area where people tend to be irrational and believe non-taxable income is always the best thing to get no matter what. As well, we're dealing with a divorce situation, which tends to throw rationality out the window quite often as well, in which case the fact that the other party would get a break is a negative. If, though, in fact, the payments will be not alimony, then if you're representing the paying spouse, you need to tell them they need to insist the payments will be lower than they otherwise would be. So the paying spouse, you know, we take into account the tax consequences. Now, again, quite often you're not going to be able to get an optimal result, even though mechanically it'll be easy. But you need to point out to the parties, or at least to the party you're representing, you know, the potential issue of that. If you're representing a recipient, note the issue that if you're going to take it as taxable, you want a higher payout, and the other party should probably be able to afford a higher payout because they can get lower after tax by going that way. Similarly, if you're going to be faced with, as the side of the one who will be paying, a recipient who insists absolutely none of the payments shall be treated as alimony, they're not going to include any as income, then you need to tell your spouse that essentially, the spouse you're representing, that your position is going to be the payout will be lower than it will otherwise be. In essence, this is not a zero game where that little issue makes no difference. It makes a difference as to how much will be paid out. If done correctly, it is very possible to get a win-win for both sides. The key is to have enough cooperation to make that happen. Finally, you take over a client or you get a client after the divorce decree has been done, end of day, everything's over. What the Johansson case makes clear is you need to see a copy of the divorce decree. You need to take a look at all of the provisions where basically money changed hands. You need to take a look at, looking at all those provisions, whether they meet the four-prong test. Whether you're the payor or recipient spouse, you need to look at the four-prong test and take your payments against that. You absolutely cannot rely just upon the taxpayer's own statements in this area, or if you do, don't be surprised to find out that their perceptions of what happens are very different than the reality. Now, this particular case, as noted, is one of a string of them. There have been a number of cases over the years that have dealt with this death of spouse provision. And I happen to agree with the tax court judge that, to be quite honest, none of these cases should have ended up in front of the court. This is a matter that needs to be dealt with back when we're closing out the divorce settlement. One problem you're going to run into is, quite often, these agreements, as all these cases point out, deal nothing with the tax issue. You may or may not find that counsel for the parties in the divorce decree and divorce settlements have the requisite tax knowledge to make this work. Therefore, you need to be proactive for your clients and indicate you need to be sure these tax matters were properly considered. Now, this has been the tax update for Saturday, June the 3rd, 2006. Tax update is brought to you by Lineberg Information Services on the web at www.lineberg-services.com. Again, they offer tax information to the subscribers and regular email newsletters on tax developments. This has been the tax update.